Where do you live, Luke?
I'm in Bristol.
Bristol.
I'm back from Bristol now.
Bristol. My geography is failing me.
It's in the southwest. You know where the sort of the UK kicks out. A bit. It's like the sort of elbow there, just under Wales.
Just under Wales. Okay, so not quite out like Pirates of Penzance territory. It's not.
No, quite not quite. Finished. No, but when you go deep Bristol, they sound like that. Okay. A little bit, you know. They got the sort of that West Country drawl.
West Country drawl. Oh, yeah. I see it now on a map. Okay. So you're not like mining tin there. Like,
no, not quite.
It's not Exeter.
No, not quite. I mean, I don't really know. It used to be a big sort of like maritime city that is on that estuary. Rolls out. So it's like, I think Eric Robinson has this line in Slavery and Capitalism that there's not a brick in Bristol that wasn't laid with the blood of slaves. Sort of thing. Very much sort of like ingrained in the tobacco trade through the sort of 17th century, 16th, 17th, 18th century.
Your city bears the imprint of like the transatlantic trade.
Yeah.
All of the evils and goods of that. Marco, how are we doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you. Yeah, the tobacco trade, it comes back to us because I started working in the hospital about 5 years ago during COVID on the respiratory ward. And like a lot of the patients there, especially the female patients with respiratory problems, were factory workers in the big tobacco factory. And they got cheap cigarettes there. So they all ended up with COPD on our ward. And it was always like, it bites us in the end.
Yeah,
we are here. I'm just going to go ahead and start this podcast. We are here with Luke and Marco from the Angry Workers. I just want to say Angry Brigade because I think of that Oi band. Or
oh, be careful with that, please.
Yeah. I would never.
We have on a list.
I would never say it. No. Angry Workers. This is your second appearance on the show. We're here to speak with you guys about your various publications on your website, also Vital Signs, your magazine devoted to healthcare. And I believe that you guys are starting on the early phases of promoting a new documentary that's coming out soon. Is that right?
That as well, yeah. If you want to hear about that, we can talk about the film, yeah. It's in the making.
We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it. We're going to start hyping it because it sounds really good. Angry Workers, I've always appreciated what you guys have done and considered you compatriots from across the pond because Angry Workers take seriously the day-to-day struggles of the working class there in Britain at a time when it seems like British and both American politics, let's call it Anglosphere politics, because Australia, you're complicit in this too, is taking on a chauvinistic, xenophobic, big P political sort of nationalist tint. Angry Workers, you guys are keeping a very important politics alive. I would say our politics broadly here on the communist left of taking working class agency seriously, subjectivity seriously, but also the conditions of work at the point of production in neighborhoods, in homes and elsewhere seriously. And for that, I applaud you. And I'm super excited to have you back. So Luke and Marco, thanks for coming back.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, I was going to ask as kind of an icebreaker, if you will, guys. It's been several years. In fact, I believe for me, and this is how I tell time, it was two apartments ago that we had you guys on the podcast. And I'm not sure, was it the two of you or were they just different angry workers that we had at that time?
I think it was myself and Kieran. We were both mainly working in West London, and in the meantime, we shifted to Bristol because my kids live here. So, we left West London, but yeah, we could pick up from where we left it last time.
Where we left last time, as I recall, is you guys put out an incredible compendium. It was like almost like a documentary book. That sounds ridiculous, but Class Power on 0 Hours, which was your collective kind of theorizing and thinking through the various different workers' struggles that you've engaged in, not from the outside, but from the inside, living and working in West London and throughout Great Britain, right? Trying to kind of understand class composition as it exists right now and the experience of working class people. So this, I think it's exciting to see you guys continuing on that work. What have you been doing since the book came out, since the publication of the book?
Yeah, I mean, when the book came out, COVID hit. And so we were a bit like, you know, lost in the lockdown. But
we
managed by that time to kind of get more contacts in other parts of the UK, so beyond West London. And we engaged in a series of interviews with workers mainly in essential industries. So like from midwives to tube drivers to airport workers, warehouse workers. Who else did we interview? Do you remember?
There were some teachers in there as well. I think interesting, like school students, which I mean, slightly different, but their perspective on it. The couriers were there. I mean,
The idea was like that all of a sudden the whole society talks about essential industries. How does the food end up in the supermarket? Because there was no food in the supermarket for a while. And we wanted to know how those people who can't necessarily work from home experience the lockdown and the first weeks of the COVID pandemic. And we discovered that there was a serious level of worker control initially, at least when management and also the government didn't know what to do. And so there was like a restriction, a self-restriction of workers. For example, the midwives would only do certain home visits that are really necessary. The tube drivers would reduce the shift time in order to avoid like crowded times in the break rooms.
Right.
And all that was like imposed more or less from below. And we turned it into a little pamphlet. And that was the first more collective project that we did beyond West London. And for us, it was interesting that moment of the pandemic then quickly turned into an attack on workers. So like, especially in the, you know, airport and airline industries, there was like fire and rehire. So they used the pandemic to sack people and hire them on worse contracts. Inflation went up. So we had the hope that in the response to these attacks, workers would take the bit of control that they experienced during the initial time of the pandemic to also have more control over the strikes. Mm-hmm. So we tried to push that line, but it was marginal, but there was a chance.
Luke? Yeah. I mean, so obviously there was that project, and I think that it's quite easy to forget now, like the speed with which you went from, you know, lockdowns. And I remember like lockdowns kind of in the middle of the first one, you know, there was this wave of wildcat strikes at Amazon facilities.
Right. Yes.
Over, and this was probably like late 2021, early 2022 or something like that. Or it might have been a year later. And we saw it as like, okay, this is like the germ, you know, this is what we've been trying to draw attention to in this situation where we say, okay, like we're faced with this overwhelming crisis. And in this crisis, it's like confirmation of our politics, you know, in a sense that workers took it upon themselves to, you know, decide what rules were necessary at what times. And, you know, we saw these sort of like wildcat strikes kicking off, and then there was a wave of sort of official strikes in the UK to the point where it's like the biggest collection of strikes and days lost to industrial action since you know, the 80s, with the exception of one sort of like symbolic strike in the early 2010s. And you know, we sort of like wrote on this as well. I had some dialogue with other collectives like Notes from Below in the UK. Wrote a series of texts sort of like reflecting on the strike wave, drawing on this sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better term, sort of inquiry that we'd done, or sort of this series of interviews to get a sense of how workplace management was affected by the pandemic and how that could be translated into control over these strikes. And you know, I went to a series of conferences, sort of like rank and file conferences, and talked and shared these sort of criticisms and analyses, because at the same time as we'd seen this sort of germ, when it came to the official industrial action, we saw a lot of sort of relinquishing of control over the strikes. So you saw a lot of, I mean, on the one hand, it's a lot of people's first time encountering any sort of industrial action, any sort of workplace organizing on a mass scale.
So you're saying that in the transition from sort of unofficial, from below rank and file slowdowns and work to rules and unofficial strikes, the movement from that to like UNISOM, like big federations, top-down strikes, lost some of that same energy. And you think that maybe the inexperience of the people who had just kind of come up into this movement accounts for that?
I'd say like that doesn't count for part of it. Yeah, at the same time, there's just sort of no infrastructure or say like institutional memory of self-organization. I think was a real limiter. There was no sort of political alternative. I don't know if you'd agree, Marco, but in the sort of the strike wave, it felt like there were moments where it's okay, we could broaden this out. You know, I remember a big sort of demonstration in Bristol where it's like thousands of people going around from picket line to picket line. And we can probably get onto it, but there was this sort of like pop-up political group campaign when Enough is Enough that had these series of sort of five social demands. These are like lower rent, lower energy bills, guaranteed housing, cheaper food, blah, blah, blah. And this demonstration was done under that rubric, but there was no sort of infrastructure to connect these things, and in fact they're all like remained very separate. I mean this could be seen like in the strike wave in general, but also in particular workplaces. I mean if you want to, I don't know, the hospitals.
I think there was something to that moment because it was international as well. I mean you in the US you experienced something similar at the same time. End of COVID, let's say a few wildcat strikes, and then also like a takeoff, you know, the big resignation, you know,
right.
People leaving their jobs. And I think there was something to that moment also because during the pandemic, people realized, you know, what is actually an important job and what is not, like what is a bullshit job and what is necessary, and how could we actually, you know, reduce working times quite drastically if we would focus on the essentials. So all that was present in this kind of moment. So these kind of strikes couldn't have taken a whole different political dynamic. So it was about inflation. It was like, you know, energy prices too high. If there would have been an organic connection of singular strikes with these more political demands, like we want a rent cap, we want an energy cap, energy price cap. It was in the air. The problem was also the left. I mean, if you look at Enough is Enough, and also maybe today the new Your Party, the left party, we can talk about that. It was a top-down thing. It was like some people who were like in the vacuum that was left after the Corbyn experiment collapsed in the Labour Party. They set up like Enough is Enough as a kind of political platform. But it was not connected to the rank and file. You know, it was like a power game between various factions within the left, within the trade union leadership.
So Enough is Enough for those of us who are not familiar with it was a like the left wing of the trade union movement was trying to put up political demands in this social crisis to try to push the Labour Party?
I don't know. They certainly came out of nowhere. It was massive, right? And it was these big names that came out of the Corbyn movement and Momentum, which was like, I say, the equivalent of the DSA to a Bernie Sanders style relationship. It was Momentum. And they sort of like came out of that as it collapsed. And they like some of the sort of leaders of these big trade unions said, oh, let's have like a some sort of like popular alliance and we'll concretize these sort of like five demands. And it for a moment it was like, okay, I'm kind of skeptical, you know, it seems like a bit of a power game, but at the same time thousands of people are turning out to these meetings, the five social demands, you sit there and you go, okay, you can't really argue with these. And in the middle of a strike wave, you know, this sort of like really renewed sense of industrial struggle, there was this moment of potential where it was like, okay, this could go somewhere, but it entirely fell apart under the weight of factional squabbles. You know, it's like the leader of one trade union didn't want to cede certain control to these people. There was arguments over whether they set up local branches or if it's just, you know, the self-selecting executive sets the program. And yeah, and it just sort of like it crumbled away into nothing. You know, it was bizarre.
It's tragic.
What does this story tell us about the state of the UK left, because what I hear happening, it sounds very similar to, you know, and we had Max Shanley on the show a couple months ago before the big your party convention that seemed to blow up. Some people said it was a success. Most people just kind of laughed at it. But what are these two experiences kind of tell us about where the left is? And then bonus question, maybe a little fly in the ointment question, because I've read your website, your thoughts on this, but do you guys consider yourselves part of the left? Boom, that's a big question. So firstly, what do these examples say about the left? And then where do you guys fit into all this?
Well, I think it shows a bit that the left is not really anchored in the big workplaces. You know, they're mainly acting in a kind of detached political online sphere, it seems. So, like, maybe, you know, certain sectors like education, there might be a bit more like a direct connection between the political sphere, the discussions, and actual life in the workplace. But if you take, for example, with Enough is Enough, it was led by Unite, kind of so-called left leaders. But if you would see what Unite does on the ground during that strike wave, then you see that, you know, it's built on sand, or it's built on a very kind of divisive politics. So one of our comrades, he works at the Heathrow Airport, the biggest airport in Europe, and there the management attacked workers specifically in passenger traffic, like, you know, airline traffic, while at the same time the cargo department was working overtime because they had to bring all the stuff, you know, from China and to, you know, kind of supply the pandemic situation. But the union quickly made a deal with the cargo section and said, okay, we don't have a leg to stand on in terms of passenger traffic because, you know, it's all down, so we can't really build any strengths. So even like these small examples that have to come to the fore when it comes to, you know, what is a working class line here, you know, the guys in the cargo department could have used their strengths to defend their colleagues there, but even although they're in the same union, they didn't. And these unions are then, you know, referred to as the main representatives of the working class or the left unions. And we try to kind of encourage a bit more detailed analysis. How is this strike wave working? And from there, we have to develop a program, not like, you know, from the, you know, drawing boards of some left conferences, basically.
Yeah, I'd agree, obviously, with Marco. I mean, it is a problem of detachment, right? And it seems to be also like a very predictable pattern now of just refusing to learn any lessons. Obviously, like, you can look at the sort of social democratic or democratic socialist gambit over the last sort of like 20 years. And each time, each cycle, you know, with Syriza, with Podemos, with, you know, even Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, you have a sort of like post-mortem and it goes, okay, these are the mistakes we've made. You know, we substituted, you know, politicking for organizing, this sort of thing. And they go, okay, we need to go back to the grassroots and we need to develop our, you know, build, you know, tenants unions, trade unions. And then as soon as like the sort of the newest shooting star comes down, this sort of like flashy opportunity, it's like, oh no, actually now what we need to do is we need to go into backroom committees and struggle over, you know, the structure of this new party that doesn't really exist. You know, it was called by sort of like two left celebrities who sort of tweeted contradictory things on Twitter, and then suddenly it sort of like galvanized. And I think it was particularly disappointing because, like, in the US, in France, Germany, etc., there was a lot of discussion around this sort of like neo-Kautskyist tendency at the time in the left. You know, what would a mass workers party be like? What would it function? What would its function be in a revolutionary process, etc.? And that's a debate that we tried to intervene in. We wrote a long text sort of critiquing the argument and the discussion and the terms it was being had on. And then this happened in the UK where, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana said, here's a new party, and then everyone sort of dissolved into it, you know. And it's been I mean, interesting to watch, I suppose. And then
on to watch. That's a very politic way to put it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, we've gone to some of these meetings with the idea of, okay, what do we need? We need sort of like, or how we envisage like communist work being is the idea of sort of having concrete inquiries based in concentrations of the working class. That's another thing on the side note for the contemporary left doesn't really have much of a working definition of what class is, I think, and it becomes a very flat category. But we've gone to these things hoping to sort of meet people who are like, okay, like, you know, I work in, you know, the postal service or, you know, supermarkets or warehouses or whatever, that we can say, okay, here's a project that we've got, which is, you know, a political project based in hospitals that offers a sort of concrete analysis of the industry and the day-to-day struggle and hopes to sort of build some sort of political forum there. And there hasn't really been space at these big Your Party meetings to do that. It's all very much like, you know, what words should we use in the constitution, you know, right. What should the recall process for a delegate after 3 years be? It's difficult to see any seriousness in the idea of working class self-organization coming from these spaces.
Interesting. Kind of, I wouldn't say exactly matches experiences I've been having in here in New York over the last 6 months, but we had a bright and shiny new thing named Zoran. You guys may have heard of him. He's, I think, not just America's mayor, but he's maybe the mayor of the entire global left at this point in time. So popular is his program and his Instagram feed. But I'm not sure you guys caught up on this because I don't pretend that you listen to all of our shows. But we did have, I had a discussion with my friend Z about an event I went to about a month before the mayoral election. And it was called Construction Workers for Zoran. And so I went there. I think you guys will find this interesting. And I went there and there was a lot of faces from what was, I think, the New York City equivalent of Enough is Enough. It was maybe 10 years ago. It was billed as like a rank and file construction, like building trades movement of apprentices and journey people who were coming together in order to kind of create solidarity between the different business unions, between the different trades, between the different crafts, and kind of promising a ground up sort of new sort of unionism. Well, it fell on its face in a lot of the same ways I think the Enough is Enough thing did. It kind of got subsumed back into the union structure. So the construction workers for Zoran was many of these same people who have been like you guys and like us, like all of us fighting like a fight for many, many years. They didn't, unfortunately, at this meeting, the secret meeting I went to, I was trying to get an answer from them, which is like, what do you propose to do that's different? You know, what would this mayoralty do that's different from Bill de Blasio, who was a good progressive mayor we had here in the city? And what the, I guess the answer that I wanted, and maybe the answer, Luke and Marco, that you guys are posing as in your relation to this, is the answer I wanted was, okay, we have all of these, you know, I have 100 people from all these different trades. You guys are not the locals. You guys are not your unions, but you represent like a thrust within them. Let's, if not cultivate, at least like create continuous contact with like what could be seen as a dissident layer within the trades and kind of figure out a way that the mayor and these people could work together. It didn't work out. It was far too scary. But I think that shows maybe for the left what the limitations for they see the limitations are in dealing with the working class, because fundamentally it's uncontrollable, and it maybe represents a politics, and at least a latent politics that isn't the same politics as Zoran or isn't the same politics as Jeremy Corbyn even per se or whatever. I don't know what you guys think about that, but the analogy really jumped out at me when I heard you guys describing what you've seen on the ground.
Yeah, no, it sounds familiar. And I think we're not proposing to go back to some kind of, oh, let's just do something at the workplace and be a good syndicalist and leave the politics to the politicians. I mean, I think we ourselves, if we follow the chronology of angry workers, we experienced our own detachment. So after doing the West London thing, we said, okay, we try to propose that people do similar things in other industries or in other towns. And we got to know quite a few people, but like it never came to the same kind of depths of or the same kind of intensity of, let's say, organizational efforts within the class. So we became a kind of a bigger organizational group on a national level. But, you know, we were mainly like writing maybe an interesting article or having a good conference meeting in Sheffield or in Leeds or wherever we met. But we were not producing new experimentation or experiences of working class politics. So, you know, we got fairly frustrated, and then Ukraine happened, and that also created a lot of discussions within the collective. We could go into that, but don't have to. But basically, we decided to reduce ourselves, you know, to that experience in these two hospitals where we are at the moment. So in order to actually create something new, a different kind of politics rather than just, you know, a discourse, you know. And maybe we can start talking on that, what the reality is and what we're trying to do at the moment.
I think that would ground things nicely. All right, sounds good. So how have you you said you've moved back into practical activity. I guess that's how I would say it, right? Searching for, and I think this is truly the golden road here. This is the golden path. As I see it, trying to understand how something new might arise, experimenting enough, being grounded enough in the class, in things like workers' inquiries and understanding class composition, understanding subjectivity of workers, imagining a politics that might be different. So how has this project unfolded, and what have you learned in the hospitals and outside the hospitals over the last couple of years or so?
You want to go, Marshall?
Yeah, I start with the moment, let's say, that was about 5 years ago, where we also saw like an international uptake of struggles in the health sector, also starting from the US. I mean, there were, you know, a lot of situations where the pandemic both brought like some confidence to workers and say like, hey, we keep this stuff running here. We are needed. You know, we are not invisible anymore. Plus, it also like the staffing problems. I mean, it was basically the last straw.
Yeah.
So people felt confident at the same time, completely overwhelmed. So that, I think, sparked off some militancy. And we also saw it in Germany, where I'm from, where especially in Berlin and the bigger hospitals, you had quite a new type of delegate system that also was semi-encouraged by the union, that was more rank and file initially. And demands that were not just monetary, but about staffing levels, where workers themselves, ward by ward, department by department, establish what is the need in terms of workforce and come up with a plan. So that was quite a new quality. So, we started working in the hospital. I started about 5 years ago. And just to set the scene, it's like two big hospitals in town. They're the biggest hospitals in southwest of England, with about 18,000 workers in total. And I never worked in a hospital before. I had a lot of comrades who worked in a hospital, but you know, I'm more used to like, you know, construction sites or factories. So it was a new experience in that sense. Because unlike, for example, in West London, where we had, you know, mainly a migrant workforce in warehouses and food factories and things. There we also have migrant workforce, but they are doctors. English is not a problem. I think over 50% of people have like a university degree, because if you're a nurse, so we deal with a very different workforce that is quite, you know, kind of more closely attached to something also like knowledge production. So it's not just care work in the sense of, you know, health workers are the good guys who, you know, do like a lot of emotional labor and all that, you know, that may be true as well, but like it's a much more somehow scientific work as well. If you look at, you know, application of pharmaceutical research, or I work in surgical theaters now. Like there's quite a global industry of implant or equipment manufacturers. So it's like it combines a scientific field, universities, with a concrete application, which is like healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating, and it does kind of serve as this nodal point for all sorts of other industries, as you said. Just a quick little sidebar here, Marco, where you're telling me this story, and you work in surgical theaters. I went to I had surgery 6 months ago. I had to get my elbow repaired, and so they had to put a plate in. This was such an American experience. Maybe you would have this under the NHS, but I don't think so. I went into the surgical theater. They rolled me in on the gurney. And inside were like two competing metal plate salesmen, and they were pitching the surgeons on their different wares, and they were having like a demonstration in front of me, and I was awake and I'm watching these guys, sales basically, like trying to convince the surgery to buy one of these plates or the other, presumably to use inside my body. So that was going on, and that really does show this sort of interpenetration of capital into this process, where we tend to, I think, want to kind of take healthcare work and put it into like a pink collar thing. We want to say it's like, oh, well, maybe they're producing health like a factory produces, but it's broader than that. It touches on like every aspect of capitalist production and reproduction, obviously, of capitalist society too. So it's not surprising to me that it's been a very fruitful place for you guys to learn, to do workers' inquiries and whatnot. Luke, did you want to add to what Marco had to say?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I wanted to add was just like politically, I mean, off the back of the pandemic, you have sort of healthcare, and like we've been theorizing for years about the idea of like essential industries, right? Taken for the perspective of what would be required, let's say, for revolutionary transition. And, healthcare kind of fell particularly starkly into that category at the time, and something that we hadn't considered as much, there was a lot of focus on logistics. I worked in a caravan factory for years, and with the sort of the political situation in the pandemic, off the back of the pandemic, where you could have easily imagined a situation where if there was a level of political, for lack of a better term, consciousness in the health industry, you can quite easily imagine a situation where health workers could have almost imposed an alternative management of the crisis. And I think that's part of the reason why, Marco and other comrades ended up working in these hospitals in the early discussions, and certainly why I sort of like got involved and got a job there later on, is because also in terms of the sort of like composition of, let's say, of the working class in an economy like the UK, There's a certain social responsibility that comes with healthcare work, right? And it's often weaponized against workers to disparage any idea of, industrial action, organizing, whatever. Some sort of weird blackmail where it's like, oh, because your work is meaningful, you can't be, consider yourself as workers.
Right.
And I think that for us, I mean, this offered like quite an interesting and kind of necessary thing to work to understand, and especially, I mean, the NHS is the biggest employer in the UK. We're talking like about 1.2, 1.4 million employees in the UK. I mean, and that is just like directly employed workers. Yeah. Then you think about all of the work that is tied to the maintenance of these places, where, the deliveries, contracts outwards. I mean, you're talking like a huge... at least, at a very abstract level, connectivity of workers. It was worth for us to excavate whether, whether there is a class character here, like a subject that's possible but unrecognized or anything like that. And I think that, in our mode of operating, the only way for us to work that out is to be there, yes. and try and get a sense of it.
Yeah, I greatly admire that. And I want to stop and I want to put a pin in something, because I don't think that we should just drop it or just let it hang in the air. But like this possibility, this potentiality, which you say existed, is for like a settlement of the social crisis of COVID on the working class's terms, actually coming out of like the experience and self-organization of the working class, being able to impose certain things. This is an older vision of what the working class, the proletarian socialist left is, right? And it's one that just lives and breathes common sense for me, but it's one that's so lost, it seems like. I want to connect this to your experience with your party people, and I want to connect it too to my limited experience with the Zoran people, you know, which is that, like, this is, I think, a plausible and effective and an important way to look at and to understand power in this society if we want locuses of power to arise that are not what this ruling class is presenting to us. Because I don't know about you guys, being here in the United States, Andy and I have been speaking about our recent military endeavors in Latin America, recent 37-year-old American citizen women, moms who have been shot in the face, you know, the climate change. You know, obviously none of this has went away just because we had a vibe shift like a year or so ago. It's so tough right now to like grasp onto something like a vision of the world that's democratic, but that's real, you know, and that is based on the actual production and reproduction of society. And I've had the feeling, and I think it sounds similar to you guys for a while now, that like there is no responsible actor, that this ruling class of ours, certainly our political class, and I think the capitalist class wants to take us to a place we don't want to go, but our political class, right, is falling down on the job and has been for a long time. And who is it that's going to take responsibility over the production and reproduction of society? And I think you tying that social responsibility that comes with healthcare work to the greater responsibility of our class to ultimately take ownership, to take responsibility over society, you know, i.e. socialism, right? I think that is super essential. And I think that's what makes your, I don't want to blow too much smoke up your ass, but that's why I like angry workers a lot. And why I think that what you guys are doing there is so important. So you can take my compliments or you can respond to anything I said, either way.
Yeah, maybe both. Thank you. But like sure. To actually look what would have been required to come up with an alternative, let's say, working class response to the pandemic. I mean, it was clear that the state can't hold together, let's say, a pharmaceutical industry, a kind of academic sphere that is detached. Even the hospitals and the elderly care is so like fragmented nowadays. There were thousands of deaths in the UK because there was no coordination between hospital testing and the social care sector or elderly care sector. Mm-hmm. So privatization has completely ripped all these kind of connections apart. And it becomes very clear that it's connected to the question of day-to-day struggle. So like these divisions that exist between all these sectors, if in our day-to-day struggle we can't unite a struggle or strike of doctors with the one of nurses or of the nurses with healthcare assistants and cleaners, if we can't create that kind of collectivity, then it's also very difficult to imagine that we can coordinate a response. So what vital science is about is like an inner, let's say, critique of how this industry is structured, how, let's say, the expert kind of knowledge of the doctor recreates a hierarchy that is kind of by now quite unnecessary. And say, like, if we want to take over this social responsibility, we not only have to understand our industry, we have to undermine all these kind of divisions that this system puts in our ways. You know, they don't hold this stuff together anymore. We have to do that. Right. And that's a conflictual situation, if especially now, like the last action that we tried to organize, we are both also union reps and we are to enforce it against our union, was like a rally for migrant workers who are under attack at the moment because the labor government changes the visa regulations and the regulations for indefinite leave to remain. We had a lot of conversations with colleagues from mainly India, Philippines, African countries, about these issues. And people were angry, you know, it's a clear line of division. They want to show us, yes, we need you. We don't want to admit that, but don't feel safe here. Don't think that you can raise any kind of demands. But there's not the confidence yet, maybe unlike in the US where you had Si Se Puede, where migrants would go out and say like, no, you guys need us and we fight for our rights. That hasn't happened yet. But also because there were not many general strike of nurses where these migrant nurses could go on a picket line together with, let's say, native nurses and stuff, where you build up this kind of confidence. So yeah, we try to reflect on all these things. You know, how is knowledge production segregated? How is the industry like globalized? Basically, software industry, Palantir, U.S. company. I mean, that's what they want to
contract. You guys have Palantir in your NHS?
Well, it's been contracted to create a single database of all sort of patient data and system.
And then you're gonna have what? Keir Starmer, what are they calling? Kid Starver is also rolling out fucking digital IDs now. Palantir and your NHS combining databases, and you're gonna have your digital ID. Dude, it's feeling more and more like, I don't know, Blade Runner or some shit out here. Certainly in the UK, it's like shit's dire. I don't know. Fucking have a revolution.
But at the same time, I mean, to go back to what you're saying, I mean, it is like, it's fundamentally something that we have to like cling on to, not just like as like an abstract thing of hope, you know, for revolution or whatever. But when we talk about like the concrete experience of like self-organization and taking responsibility for our own struggles, you see it as not like it actually becomes a necessity at a point, right? I mean, it's like we also had a struggle in the hospital that they were closing the last NHS run detox center, you know, for sort of like people, alcohol or substance abuse issues, where, you know, they would go in as an inpatient and stay for rehabilitation. And they were closing this down, and, you know, we got in contact with the workers there, you know, we wrote articles about it. We offered to host meetings, and there was this sort of thing of like, oh, we're not sure what the union's doing. You know, the union has said, wait, you know, this sort of thing. You know, and we were going to go around live awards and like leaflet their emergency department, sort of like try and create this you know, very concrete image of the fact that actually one aspect of our work has a knock on to the rest. And unfortunately it was kind of like dismantled by patience, you know, like saying, oh, we'll wait and see what the union's going to do. And the union never really got involved. And then, you look at that struggle, and, you know, when we're reflecting on it, it's like what it would have taken is for workers to take more ownership over that struggle. And you can take this back to the strike wave, you know, a lot of these strikes that were massive, you know, over inflation's effect on wages ended up settling for below inflation pay deals, you know. And it's like, it's not just like an ideological fixation, you know, everything must be grassroots and democratic to the core, but it's a strategic and tactical necessity. At a point, and like, you know, to come back to what you're saying about our frustrations with the Your Party thing, is that that has all felt very much like detached. You know, it's like we get the program in place, we sell the program, things will fall into line, we do a bit of political education on the side, we say get involved with tenants unions, trade unions, but without this sort of strategic sort of positionality where it needs to be a process of self-organization and political confrontation in that way, you run into problems very quickly.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry to cut you off, Marco, but if I want to again put a pin in this, what you're saying is that, because I think there was a sense like, well, there's a new left party coming together, but it doesn't include the big trade unions. There's a sense in which, like, even if you had a buy-in from, let's say, like the labor, leaving labor and forming its own party, even that would be insufficient if you just took the actually existing labor organizations in Great Britain right now and just had them form a political program. It sounds to me like, for whatever reason, whatever prerogatives they had, that the union allowed this entire social provision of detox public to just go by the wayside, to just die on the vine without even fighting for it. So that gives an indication maybe of what sort of their politics might look like on a larger scale. And so what you're proposing then is like a new thing that comes from the bottom up. Presumably you would also need new activated rank and file unions to even imagine a new left party. Is that kind of what you're getting at? Not really.
Not sure about the new left party as a kind of, you know, party in the sense
even
of...
Even if that were desirable, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but I think what we try to do is like create a new nuclei or an experiment that can be kind of taken up and criticized also by other people. We try to be quite transparent. So we say, okay, what we're doing is political work that is attached to the day-to-day struggle. We've got lots of day-to-day struggles, but we also want to talk, for example, about militarization of the health sector, you know, which is quite, it's enormous, especially in Germany. There are new laws that, you know, can conscript you when you're a health worker, and they, you know, Germany will be
front lines to go fight Putin's Russia. You could just be press gang now if you live in Dusseldorf as a nurse to like
to work for the military sector, basically. So they know that, you know, with the very small amounts of military hospitals, both in Germany and in England, if you have a war on the scale of Ukraine, Russia at the moment, they will be filled up in 1 or 2 days. And then sure. You look at the civilian structure. And we have the same problem. The big boss of our hospital is an ex-army man. And, you know, he invites recruitment stores of the army into the hospital, these kind of things. So we try to do working class politics, internationalist politics, but very closely to relate it to, you know, where we are working and what the experiences are. We talk about, you know, revolution in our paper, but we say like, okay, what does it mean? You know, I'm trying to come to a social formation that is more conscious, more including like, you know, the decisions of majority and is actually able to meet our needs. So in pragmatic terms. So I think in that sense, parallel to our experience in the hospital, at least we are discussing some questions of the revolutionary process and transition. So we had some discussions about the fundamental principles of communist production and circulation, an old text by the group of international communists. And they'd come up with labor time accounting, a system of, you know, that is not market-based, but it's also not a five-year plan from the top down. So it's a kind of open bookkeeping kind of society. And that's very applicable to the NHS. The NHS could be a laboratory of how can you organize a very complex society with a science sector, with like a complex labor, with expert labor, with a lot of manual labor, in a more...
A lot of advanced precision surgical tools and machinery, fixed capital, right?
And what can you learn by the day to day now about like the possible reorganization of society? So all these things we want to bring up, and we encourage any kind of communist or comrade workers in other sectors to try their own things like that. That's how we intervened into this Your Party kind of debate. We said like, you know, it's all hot air unless we start to do working class politics on the ground again in that form, not just saying, oh, we defend the NHS against privatization, but really understand what the NHS is, what kind of complex intertwinement with the private sector, you know, from software to, you know, we've got these people from many American companies like Strikers in the surgical theaters, but they organize the international conferences where these surgeons learn. It's not like the NHS. The NHS is too kind of mundane national. They don't attach to the global knowledge anymore. So what does that mean for us? You know, it's like bringing up all these questions.
Interesting. Luke?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting. I just like on the back of what Marco was saying about the hospitals, you know, it's like almost you have like a small version of like uneven and combined development in a way. You know, you've got sort of like robotics and automated surgeries happening at the same time as, you know, you've got people working 16-hour days pushing trolleys around, you know, to ensure that things can get to where they need to go. And it's, you know, and it's and in a way, from that you can sort of like build a critique of the whole of sort of like capitalist development, right? Where you have like huge advances to the point that, you know, the NHS couldn't develop its own drugs, for instance, and manufacture its own drugs. I mean, that's reliant on supply chains where, you know, molecules are developed in labs in Switzerland and then, you know, exported out and
probably produced in India or South Africa.
Yeah, and then pressed into a pill in one place and then shipped over. I mean, the NHS can't do that, right? And, you know, we have to take that seriously instead of just, you know, if what, I mean, to go back to your question, are we on the left? We can say the rest of the left or the left says, which is, you know, defend the NHS against privatization. And that for us doesn't deal with the problems of the world that we need to inherit. Right. And that's why we insist on internationalism. You know, it's like and that emphasis on internationalism comes through in different ways. You know, on the one hand, when there were sort of race riots last year, we tried to sort of write a thing intervening as health workers, you know, in this like in this multinational industry, instead of just being like, you know, these guys are rabid racists, which, you know, a lot of them were, but a lot of the time it's there's a neglect to sort of offer a perspective that it's like, okay, but we're an international workforce and we need to intervene on that level. But yeah, I think that there's a lot to be done, and it's not obviously just healthcare. This can be done from anywhere. You know, if you look at say one of the food factories that the Comrades worked in West London for years, or an Amazon warehouse, you know, that there are ties and political developments and scientific developments that can be related and then circulated within the class. And I think that that's what we propose, that in order to build any idea of program or party, you first need to sort of understand the actual conditions of the class, you know, in the broadest sense you can develop them. And I think that that's the proposal that we make. You know, it's that you have to do the workforce, you can't put the cart before the horse. Yeah, you can't put the cart before the horse.
Yeah. And it becomes like international fairly quickly. I mean, you talked about the pharmaceuticals. That's one of the kind of key kind of conflicts with the U.S. kind of government. It's like, you know, pharmaceutical, you know, U.S. patents or companies, you know, do they get access? Will the NHS give more money to the pharmaceutical companies, or otherwise, you know, with the tariffs in the U.S., they have to then start manufacturing in the U.S. And they really have squeezed the Starmer government and said, like, okay, we want more money. And they gave them more money. I mean, millions. So to say, like, you know, we stay in your country, because that was the vision for UK, would be the laboratory. Now, after Brexit, we deregulate our, like, research, whatever standard or requirements, and we become the tech lab of Europe, at least. But now then they closed, I think, investment in pharmaceuticals, which was one of the prime kind of industries. Hundreds of millions of investment got frozen until the government, also under pressure of the US, would kind of, you know, cough up even more money. And all that is like, it's somehow present. I mean, that's present in the hospital. People ask these questions like, what is the world we live in? You know, I mean, these are workers that come from, you know, the global south. And they know that there are not enough nurses in India or in Philippines or in Africa. And, you know, the question is like, okay, why do we have to go to this little shit country with all the, you know, with the bad weather and when unfriendly, depressed people? So, like, why do we have to do that, you know? And, you know, that's, I think, yeah, it's the question is like, how do you promote that kind of new type of politics that talks very pragmatically about, we have to understand our industries, we have to develop a plan of, let's say, insurrection, not as a kind of big event, but like, you know, pragmatic steps. Even in our hospitals, we've got workers or comrades from anarcho-syndicalists, IWW, various Trotskyist sects. You know, it's even difficult to include them because politics for them is outside. They do trade union stuff, max. Yeah. You know, that's our problem.
No, it's interesting you say that, because, and I want to point out again where there's a sort of incipient politics here that's really important, because these great questions that you talk about U.S. pharmaceuticals, you talk about tariffs, we talk about India, we talk about China, talk about bloc politics among different capitalist nations, we talk about imperial interventions in the Caribbean or Eastern Europe or whatever the case may be. We listen to Kaya Kallas, we listen to Ursula von der Leyen or Mertz, and the world takes on an international cast, but a geopolitical cast, right? Like we're told these days when it's like a an issue with pharmaceuticals. Well, look to the United States and their global leadership. If we just look to China instead for their global leadership, open up like connections with the CPC or whatever, we'll be able to, like, I don't know, join BRICS and be part of like a cheaper trade zone, a better, more moral trade zone, a socialist trade zone, right? That is like one international vision that I think dominates not just like the Marxist-Leninist left often, but the Labor Party as well, and your conservative party, and let's be honest, the Reform Party too, right? This is the bourgeois internationalism that we are presented with. It's like, which gang of gangsters in which nation state that claims to be representing these entire people, which of them do we choose for our gangster state to operate with? Like, what are the rules in place to ensure that our gangster capitalists can create just enough jobs and we keep those jobs away from India or China? So I think that the angry workers conception, and I think I share this as well, of understanding that a different internationalism is possible, not only possible, but also, but already posited by the material world, by the movement of goods and people and capital around the globe. It already presupposes an internationalism. The one we're getting right now is a terrible one. You know, the capitalist one is a very bad one, breaking up into these different blocks. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm filibustering right now, but I'm giving my thoughts on all the stuff that you either say. One thing that jumped out at me when you were speaking earlier about essential workers, and this is maybe something that I haven't grappled with in a year, 5 years or so, because the pandemic, I think, was so troubling and traumatizing. Maybe a lot of us have been trying to get past it, right? But you're right about that essential workers thing. You're right about there was this sense that all sorts of networks, all sorts of logistics, all sorts of human labor was becoming visible in a way that it hadn't been before. That even calling it, the ruling class calling it essential workers, right, automatically kind of unveiled a hidden world that existed behind the world of media spectacle and you know, rentierism or whatever the fuck it is that we deal with on our day-to-day basis. And that was, I think, a lost opportunity. And I think that the idea of imagining that score being settled on the working classes side takes only even more import now when we see what it is that the capitalist class has done with that, because they learned the same lessons that we do, right? They saw that this essential work category became a divisive one, became one that realized or revealed various different conflicts and necessities within society that they don't like either. They don't like there being like 100, 200, 300 million workers who hold the whole fucking thing up, who they have to pay well. So I guess what I'm trying to say is similar to the bourgeoisie's proposal for internationalism is like geopolitics and block politics and warfare between different capitalist states. So too is like there is an internationalism of the bourgeoisie, and it's AI. Right. And it's like they say, like, let's get this AI revolution going. We don't like essential workers either. We're going to use artificial intelligence and U.S. tech and Palantir and Grok or whatever to eliminate those essential workers as well. It's just that, as with geopolitics, their plan is terrible for the working class. Right. It's a terrible plan to just get rid of like a billion jobs and then replace it with what? I don't know. We're all like Instagram famous or something. I don't know. What do you guys think of that that train of thought?
I think we have to see where the class finds answers to these questions, at least kind of minimally. And I just spent some time in Italy, where we had an internationalism of a new quality in the sense of the dock workers calling for a general strike in case the global flotilla. Solidarity flotilla for Palestine is attacked, and it was attacked. And there was actually, although no one believed it, there was a general strike, or at least like a mass movement that hasn't been seen like in Italy for the last 30 years, the biggest kind of street protests and blockades. And we did interviews with these dock workers and how they were able to basically, you know, take up their social responsibility. They know that, you know, how many arms go through their port. they are in connection with other port workers. There is an old kind of internationalist spirit that is given to the nature of the industry and the nature of the workforce. And they were able to basically combine with their fellow workers in towns like Marseille or Piraeus in Greece or Barcelona and say like, okay, we have to take over this responsibility and no arms through our ports. And partly because it's a danger for us and for the town. And also because this militarism, you know, it pushes up inflation, it leads to austerity. Mm-hmm. And they were able to be that figure for the working class. People were looking to them because they knew these, although they are diminished since containerization, outsourcing, they're still like, you know, an international force. And if we see that in Italy, that combines with at least two other struggles that have like it's an international dimension. One is the GKN workers, like ex-car workers who occupied their factory and try to build a movement around it for the defense of this kind of productive capacity as a community asset, together with climate change movement or movement against climate change with engineering students to say, how can we convert the production in this factory? So they're raising issues, you know, 500 workers who had like a long-standing factory collective to take on that plant and to come up with an alternative plan. We know about the limits of alternative or self-management, but they definitely said, you know, it's not for us to own the factory. It's for turning it as an asset of the movement and as an example of what workers can do in order to do something against climate change. If we know that in Germany, for example, the car industry is going to go down. I mean, there will be not like 500, there will be 500,000 job cuts minimum. So that sets a signal. You know, that happening in close proximity, dock workers doing these kind of anti-war stuff, car workers saying, we don't want this industry either. Plus, like migrant workers, like, you know, logistics or textile workers that we met were migrant workers in Italy, and they push up the wages at the moment. From the lowest level, they say, okay, we didn't come here to be, you know, exploited like back in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So that's like a microcosm where the class could develop some kind of future program that is not sterile, that is not like, oh, we come up with nice demands, but actually from their material conditions and struggles. And we have to magnify these examples. I think that's our role mainly.
Well, yeah. I think you're doing a great job of it. I feel like we're kind of maybe winding down, or at least we're leaving things at a good spot to leave them. Luke, did you have maybe some final words? And would one of you two, before you leave, give us just a little bit more information about the documentary coming out, because I think it's going to be an important thing. Go ahead, Luke.
Yeah, I don't really have any final words. Just that I think that this process of us as worker militants, as like communists in society, right, taking on a responsibility to look at the industries we're involved in, to analyze them and relate them to the day-to-day struggle and try and close this conceptual gap between, you know, a revolutionary venture, a revolutionary gamble, and, you know, the day-to-day struggle over, you know, whether your boss will give you the day off on a certain day. I think this is a necessity and where actually we should start from, you know. And it's not leaving the analysis of the global situation aside, you know, we do that, but we do it in a way that we try and relate it to, let's say, the position of where us and our co-workers are. And I think that this is like the starting point of communist politics. And I think that it's, you know, it's similar to what, you know, people like Jasper Burns talk about in his new book, and you know, a lot of the stuff coming out of that sort of school of thought. And at the same time, it's kind of the ideal of where the democratic socialists actually want to be. And I think that in order to recognize that sort of vision, this sort of work is necessary. But I'll leave the documentary to Marco. It's
excellent.
It's his baby. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, the documentary is very related to this. It's a documentary that I do with like LaborNet TV, which is a German collective. They do a lot of documentaries on workers' struggles. And we thought like it would be good to have a documentary on the question of revolutionary transition. Looking at, okay, what is the highest mark that our class left in recent time? And we look at the 70s. So we had interviews with comrades in Portugal who were part of the 74-75 revolution and talked about the worker content of that revolution. People who had, you know, young proletarians who had to fight in Angola, and also talked about the, let's say, the resistance inside the army. We talked with comrades in Italy mainly, who were part of, you know, the political workers' committees in energy sector and hospitals. We talked to the dock workers. So that's like, let's say, our history. And we don't want to just celebrate it, although nowadays a lot of people don't know what our class was able or capable to do, you know. Sure. So it's like, it's mainly the question, like, how did they defeat us? So it looks at the process, you know. One comrade here from who was part of Angry Workers, he was like a car worker in the 70s and aerospace, and he describes like how globalization, repression, I mean, all these kind of things slowly undermined our strengths. We look then into a bit more current theoretical debate about the question of what is a, you know, communist mode of production or transition. So we talk to people who are part of the Initiative for Democratic Labor Time Accounting. So they rediscovered the fundamental principles of communist production and circulation, and they try to bring it up to speed. You know, how can we, under modern circumstances, think that we can run like a democratic kind of economy? That's like not a nice kind of idea, but like, or not nice phrasing, but it's about like, basically, how can you avoid both market and like 5-year plan? We talked to Jasper Burns about his book, you know, The Future of Revolution, and to our engineering friend, Nick, about Nick the question. Chavez.
Nick Chavez. Yes. Everybody's friend.
Yeah. And basically about like, okay, how can we imagine this kind of leap into a new society that is connected to how we produce now, but also fundamentally different? You know, what is the actual material challenge of that? And what is the organizational challenge? But we don't want to leave it that. So the main bit of the documentary will be interviews or snippets with workers in essential industries. So we spoke to car workers in Germany, water treatment, rail workers. So it will be, you know, the common question will be like, you know, how do we get out of here, and what is our role in it, and what are the pitfalls, and what is to be done at the end? Of course, that's the main question. What is organization? What is communist organization nowadays? So yeah,
this sounds exciting. Are we going to see it in this year, 2020?
Yes, you will. Probably like May, June.
Oh, coming up. Okay. Any chance we can get one of yous or multiple of yous to fucking come to New York to like do a film screening and presentation of it, maybe under the auspices of the ILC and this Wreckage podcast?
Oh, yeah. It would be nice. I've never been to America. That would be nice. Definitely.
Oh, you should come, Marco. It's a scary, terrible place, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Where is it?
I have to say, guys, speaking with you gives me hope that, I think your vision of social change and my vision, which I share largely with you, is still alive and still moving forward in this world. So let's talk about maybe a New York presentation of your upcoming documentary. But in the meantime, we'll have links for everybody in the show notes. Folks, if you're not a patron of This Wreckage, patreon.com/thiswreckage, support our work. Our important work with folks like Angry Workers and tons of others. So thanks again, guys, for being here, and thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. Take care, comrades.
Yeah, take care.